Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Gretel Ehrlich. She's the author of nonfiction, fiction, and poetry, and we're talking about her latest book, Unsolaced, Along the Way to All That Is. Gretel, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book. Hello?
Hi. I'm sorry. I am here, sort of.
You're getting soaked up in the Hawaiian sun is what's happening.
No, not really.
Now, this book is, I found, really evocative and somewhat melancholic and almost sort of a summing up of your life. I mean, your first book was The Solace of Open Spaces, and this is Unsolaced. And it's almost like, yes. I felt it was like bookends. What's happening with this book?
Well, you know, a lot of years have passed.
I know, the decades have passed.
Open Spaces. Yeah, decades and decades. Yeah, and you know, when I wrote Solace, I mean, I was just coming into the country, so to speak, in a McPhee way, coming into the country of Wyoming after the death of my friend. And, you know, I had fresh eyes, and I was welcomed on ranches in Wyoming, and I learned to cowboy, and it was sort of a new look at life, and it all seemed pretty amazing despite my loss, but mm-hmm. extraordinarily beautiful and wonderful ranching communities that seemed to accept anyone who was ready and willing to do hard work, and animals everywhere. I got to live a life with animals, which was extraordinary. And but then, you know, over the years, one discovers that the earth and civilization is really being damaged, perhaps fatally. And it was really, you know, my 23 years traveling to Northwest Greenland and traveling with the Inuit hunters in Kanak and Siaparluk, that I experienced climate change, you know, on the ice. I mean, the 15 or 20 dogs fell through the ice and in the middle of winter when it was 30 below zero. And the hunters looked at me and said, "What's wrong? This shouldn't happen." That was in 1997. And that's when I began to understand. I mean, I went home and did research and talked to climatologists, and I realized something terrible was happening to the earth as well as society. I mean, you know, are we a failed species? Why have we been so careless? Why have we accepted a kind of willful ignorance about what's happening around us and to each other? So that's sort of the font of being unsolaced.
And that's a word you created?
Yes.
Because I immediately went to try to look it up and found nothing.
I know when I write it, you know, on my computer or my phone or something, it's always red underlined. No, you can't use this word. Yes, I can. A neologism. We're allowed to make up words anytime we want.
What's interesting is you revisit a lot of the locations that you wrote books about over the years, but you keep going back to Wyoming. And the descriptions in this book of the space and the land and the animals and your livestock and your dog are just amazing to read. What is it about the physical geography of Wyoming that is so appealing to you? Is it the people and the animals, or is it the space itself, which is so open?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it begins with the space itself, and mm-hmm. You know, always seeing the horizon, always seeing, you know, the night sky. Sometimes I'm so excited at night just looking at all the stars, I can't sleep. I get up and wander around it. But then it become then it becomes populated. I mean, you know, and it's true of the Arctic too. When I read that people say it's, you know, just a wasteland. No. It's the opposite. To me, the cities are wastelands in a kind of wonderful, morbid way. But, no, I mean, I love cities for the good things they can give to us. But anyway, but I mean, when the open spaces of Wyoming became populated with a society that was so welcoming of every kind of person with every kind of ability and just filled with animals, certainly not the way it is in sub-Saharan Africa, but you know, large herds of pronghorn antelope and mule deer and elk and bears, lots of bears everywhere, and birds and, you know, birds migrating through and geese, snow geese coming down from the Arctic. And, you know, it's just, it's like, the human and the animal population plus the working dogs that became my best friends, and the horses, the working horses who, you know, who actually understand your state of mind and that, as well as what the duty is that day, what you need to get done, it all becomes one thing. You can't, after a while, you just can't separate it out. So it became everything that Wyoming, plus, of course, big mountains. I'm a kind of mountain person. I feel most at home in the mountains. I have one friend in California who called me Swiss Miss. It brought me a box of Swiss Miss hot chocolate for my birthday. It said, this is you. This is the real you.
Now, the book covers a lot of area around the globe. You go back to Greenland a number of times.
Yeah.
That becomes, for the reader, it becomes very serious as their way of life is no longer possible.
Yeah. I mean, and that once again, you know, I went there to celebrate the lives with, you know, sort of Inuit culture, which stretches from Alaska all the way across Nunavut to Greenland, at which I read about in Knud Rasmussen's ethnographic notes. I mean, I studied it, I thought about it, and they, because I arrived in my usual kind of haphazard way with no place to stay and really not proper clothes and et cetera, you know, they kind of welcomed me, like they felt sorry for me. And so they let me, you know, hop on the back of their dog sleds for 23 years. And, so I was celebrating, I mean, it's such an extraordinary culture of people who live in the harshest climate in the world and against all odds have not only survived, but really thrived in every way. And they're so astute and generous and disciplined and fun loving and, to me, they represent sort of the epitome of civilization. And but the surface on which they travel happens to be sea ice.
Right.
And the sea ice is melting, thinning, melting, or not arriving at all. And so, you know, it would be, I tell people, if you look out from wherever your house is and everything, the roads, the cars, all the food, everything is taken away, and you're just standing there. What do you do? You're lost.
It's fascinating for me to read about you and ranch life. You talk about the Buddhist practice and cowboying were all of a piece for you. That the inward life and the outward life just became enmeshed. And reading about your life there, it was a tough life. It was a really hard, especially in winter. It was a very, very tough life. Oftentimes you didn't have any, you just had to go about what you could do. but it still appealed to you. What was the appeal of ranch life besides the horses? I know the horses.
Masochism. Yeah. Well, I grew up riding, and so I grew up, you know, in utero riding. So that was we raised horses and stuff. But you know, I came to Wyoming with no money, and you know, I know a lot of people who came with money and they bought a ranch and then they had hired hands. That
yeah.
I came from the bottom up. And so, I don't know. I just thought you need to actually, as they say in Wyoming, earn your spurs. Not that it was it was deeper than that. I liked it. I liked working hard. I liked actually having contact with the harshness of the place, of the land, the animals have been kicked and bucked and having frostbite. And,
is that mostly in retrospect or while you were doing it?
Oh, no. While I was doing it. No, I could easily have left. You know, I could have moved back to New York or L.A.
Well, that's not I, the one thing I got from that from the reading your book is that's never going to happen. So
no, as I'm sadly way beyond that.
that's just not in the that's not in the cards.
I do love going for short periods of time to London and New York, and especially. But yeah,
that's not happening.
Anyway, after so many years in the boondoggles, you kind of you're just a heck.
There's quite a number of people in your book too that are just so interesting and fascinating. And I only want to talk about one. Mike, your mentor, who you describe as
a woman,
yes, a classic horsewoman, and what you learned from her was just amazing. It was essentially a way of life, a way of approaching life, I should say, a way of looking at life and what you were doing. She was an amazing person.
Yeah, she really was, and so respected. You know, everybody around her understood that almost instantly. I mean, she had this kind of inward and outward elegance and way in this quiet way with animals and a sense of right and wrong and this sardonic humor. So she loved to make fun of you very quietly. you know, people's kind of foibles that really originated in their kind of carelessness of how they were doing things. And she never made fun of me. She never, yelled at me. She never yelled at her horses or the dogs, who were often out of control. And but she was just there. She just took me on. I don't know why. She just took me on as her mentee, and we just sort of quietly went from ranch to ranch and rode together. And you know, the years went on, and she was so important to my understanding. You know, what the best qualities of the West really were. And because she'd come from the cowboys that rode with the trail herds from Texas, those were her. They weren't rich people. They weren't, people who had taken land away from anybody. You know, they were just thieves and horse rustlers and regular people. And she saw in the way they did things, because it was her grandfather who was shot in the back by the wealthy remittance men in Wyoming who were trying to get rid of the homesteaders. She understood what, you know, real equality is, what real, I don't know, just that the largesse of the land, the way in which the largesse of the land kind of informs the human being. And I think, you know, maybe that's what my book is about, that as this Sipikue Apache said, the purpose of sacred places, and by that he or she meant, actually it was a she, meant every place, is to protect the place and to perfect the human mind. And I think that she understood that innately, and she taught it to everybody around her.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Gretel Ehrlich, author of nonfiction, fiction, and poetry, and we're talking about her latest book. It is a superb read, Unsolaced, Along the Way to All That Is. Now, many of the places you visit, it's all about big open space, or even on an island, it's open space. It's Zimbabwe, it's Greenland, and it's Wyoming. But there's one place you went to in this book that the section on it sounded like oneric. It was oneric. It was like you were hallucinating. And that was when you went on this huge hike across warming land on the northwest tip of Greenland.
Right.
What the hell? That sounded wildly bad, but also fantastically, you know.
Oh, it was extraordinary.
But,
you know,
but wait a minute, you're like starving, you're cold, you're hiking like 24 hours sometimes in this land where there's not many animals. At one point,
not a single one.
You saw a glaucus gull at one point, and then you saw the feather later.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it was this huge open space that becomes your experience of it. Your sausage that you're planned on eating are going bad, and you're on this like weird forced hike up and down these incredible spaces, and somebody gets sick. And it's like,
yes, the photographer.
Now me recounting this sounds like, oh my God, it sounds like one of the worst experiences ever. Yet for you, it turned into an incredible spiritual experience.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. Well, you know, we were starvation, you know, well, starvation is the actually the pharmacopoeia of Greenland shamans, that because nothing grows there, so they starve themselves to acquire insight, you could say. Anyway, that's not why I went there. I didn't know I was going to be so hungry. No, I just thought, oh, what a great opportunity to see a part of Greenland that has never been explored before, that you can't go on by dog sled. There's no villages. There's no nothing. And what a great opportunity. So this continent of mostly ice that I came to love so much, I wanted to see, you know, more of it. I still have only seen half of it, but... I just thought it was a great opportunity. And then Dennis Schmidt, the wonderfully mad kind of leader, who was writing this, you know, extraordinary music all the way, and because he knows I love contemporary classical music, whatever you call it, he kept singing it into my ears as we were going along. Meanwhile, I was hallucinating from hunger. And it was like, oh my God, these are realms. I mean, yes, you can take psilocybin and you can do things in the comfort of your home, but that's not the way I like to do things. I want to actually have it come up from the soles of my feet. I want to.
Well, your soles, which were hurting, as well as your knees and your ankles. You were in tremendous pain half the time.
I know. When you hike really strenuously, you know, the edges of your hiking boots eventually dig into your legs.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't matter what socks you have on or whatever.
Actually, I found
the way it is.
I found your description of it absolutely. Somebody said it's the kind of silence in which you can hear the rocks getting old.
Yeah. It was like that.
And yeah, I remember it was towards the end, he goes, okay, now we're going to do a hike for, I think, 12 hours or 24 hours.
Yeah, like... well, that was Dennis at his most insane. We were just, oh, you've got to be kidding. But we had to go. Well, we went partway.
I want to talk about some of the themes in your book. You talk that you begin with two words, sentience and sundrance. And I want to talk about those two words. What do those two words mean to you?
Well, sentience is, of course, about knowing how we know what we know. Or how. Or, yes.
Like consciousness be a...
Yes. Yes, and more consciousness plus, because it also I think relates to what you feed into your mind, whether it's
feeling.
It's through your eyes or your nose or your ear, you know. It's or what you read and what you research. It's sort of everything.
But sundrance is fascinating because that's about breaking apart and forcing keeping apart.
It's about what gets lost along the way. In this long period of time that my book covers, I was ingesting so much, just ingesting Wyoming and ranch life and animals and the night sky and birds and then Greenland and, yes, the vast silence and life on the ice and et cetera. And then to see it kind of come apart. I mean, literally, that the ice breaking up under us became sort of an expression of what's happening everywhere. And so that was the sundrance that you've ingested all of this. You've committed yourself to knowing deeply as much as you can. I mean, we're all limited and flawed, et cetera, and lazy and careless and everything. But, you know, you just keep, that's the discipline. You keep trying to know better. And then at the same time that you're learning it, it's actually coming out from under your feet. It's like, you know, yeah, it's kind of a shocking situation.
Well, that's why you talk about the sharp lessons of impermanence. And a quote from you is that loss constitutes an odd kind of fullness, and despair empties out into an unquenchable appetite for life. And there's no doubt that in this day and age that things just seem to be falling apart.
Especially this week.
Oh God! Don't get me. Yeah. Don't let's go off on that tangent because. Oh my God! Oh God! Well, that you know, actually, your book sort of builds up to that. I mean, it's about when things are just falling apart, and you need a place. You always go back to Wyoming, no matter where you were, whether in California or in Zimbabwe or in Greenland. You always went
or
back.
Kosovo.
Yeah, I didn't even want to start on Kosovo.
Yeah, oh,
it's like, oh my God, but you've taken all of those experiences in this one book and sort of woven a story through them, about essentially bringing those experiences and understanding them and trying to move on through them, but. There is such a sense of melancholy, too, that sort of runs through it. Am I just reading my own reactions to this book?
No, but weren't sad about it. I mean, you know, we want to be hopeful beings. We want to see that there is a future at all for anyone or anything. And when you see extinction in action, as I did in Africa... And as well as Greenland, as well as every place, you know, it's horrifying. I mean, we just never imagined that we wouldn't have the discipline to make things right as they were.
Well, you sometimes feel helpless because the forces that are causing the destruction and the extinction just seem so bent on it. And so huge.
Yes, but on the other hand, no. Okay, so I began writing about climate change, which I experienced in 1997.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's now 2021. And has anyone done anything?
No.
To sequester? I mean, yes, farmers are. I mean, and ranchers and conservation people. Are trying to sequester carbon in the ground and in forests and that and grasslands. That's fantastic. And you know, people are sort of just waking up to this. Well, that's, you know, that's more than 20 years. And about every few years, someone says, well, we have 5 years left to make this right, and then another 5 years passes, and, you know, come on, you guys. Really, it's just a lack of discipline, a lack of imagination, because people say, oh, it's all so big, we can't imagine it, and complacency and laziness and carelessness. That literally careless. We do not care enough to do something. And so much of this, in fact, all of it could have been at the least mitigated, if not reversed. And it just hasn't happened. It still can happen if people would learn how to sequester carbon, with, you know, stop using coal.
We know what to do. We just...
No one has the will to do it because, right. You know, yeah, it's a pain in the ass, of course.
So sometimes it seems like...
You know, put on your hiking boots and climb over an unexplored peninsula in Greenland, and then, you know, not enough people, you know, sort of get up and do something. They don't even know what that means.
Well, they can't even identify the birds in their backyard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that bothers me.
Or don't want to, or don't try, or say, well, yeah, you know, we have a lot of birds that fly through everywhere we live.
I know.
Not in Hawaii so much, but we just call them, the little brown birds, and everyone laughs, and that's fine. But it means that at least you're looking.
At least you're seeing that they're little, they're brown, and they're birds.
Have all your bird books out, and you're thinking, but wait a minute.
We call them LBJs, little brown jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There's so much more we could talk about this book. And it is, for me, it was one of the best reads of the last 5 years. I just enjoyed it an awful lot.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
It's a book where the writing counts. That's what I want to mention to the audience. So no matter what we're talking about, you need to read the book. We could tell you everything that happens in the book. It's not going to matter until you read it. My guest tonight is writer Gretel Ehrlich, author of Nonfiction, Fiction, and Poetry. She does everything. And we are talking about her latest book, Unsolaced, Along the Way to All That Is. Gretel, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you again.
I know. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.